In the October 23rd session of Line of Fire Retrospect and Remembrance, Charlie D. will relate the unique story of the secret war in Europe.
In the aircraft mechanic school, Shepherd Field, Texas, was overrun with brand new B-25Gs, these brand new silver airplanes, and they took the graduating class and assigned us to maintain them. We revved up the engines every morning and gassed up all these airplanes. There were hundreds of them. And I decided that I had to do something to get out of Texas because I thought I was going to spend the rest of the war there. So I applied for instrument specialist school, which was at Chanute Field, Illinois. And lo and behold, the next day on the bulletin board, there were my orders to go to Chanute Field. After graduating from instrument specialist school, I was sent out to Salt Lake City Air Base, and from there to Mountain Home, Idaho. And we had our overseas training there. At that time, I was assigned to the 36th Bombardment Group Heavy. And after our training as a group, we were sent over to England. Now, our airplanes went on two different routes. They left Mountain Home, Idaho, and went on the northern route to Bangor, Maine, over to Newfoundland, and then over to England. And the southern route was to go to Miami Beach, South America, across to North Africa, and then up to England. I went over by boat and was sent from Mountain Home, Idaho, by rail to Camp Shanks in New Jersey. There we had some more overseas training. And one day we all boarded this beautiful white ship called the New Amsterdam. It was in New York Harbor, and it was a Dutch ship that the United States had confiscated after Hitler had overrun the Netherlands. And we left New York Harbor and zigzag across the Atlantic over the northern portion of Ireland, and we ran into a storm there. And we didn't mind flying, but we were no sailors. I think everybody on the ship was sick. And we came into the Irish Sea through the Firth of Clyde up into Glasgow Bay. We disembarked in Glasgow Bay into a little town called Gorick in Scotland. There was a big rail terminal there. And boy, we were so glad to get our 2 feet on terra firma. We left there and went by rail down to the various airfields in England. I was sent to Norwich Air Base, which is in the western part of England. And at that point of the game, I was in the 490th Bomb Group. Some of these numbers are going to be confusing to you, but if you think they're confusing to you, they switch you around in the Army, probably to confuse themselves. So one day, we got orders to leave Norwich Air Base for a destination unknown, and to leave the airplanes behind. Well, most of our crowd went from Norwich to Harrington Air Base, which was the secret OSS base that Rene was telling you about, by convoy. But a lot of us went by plane, and it was what we call piggybacking. Everybody had their duffel bags and guns, and just crowded into these B-24s. And I flew from one airfield to the other on the catwalk of the Bombay. But when we got to Harrington Air Base, that was in May 27, 1944. And we had left behind all these brand new shiny silver B-24s that all our pilots had ferried over there. And we arrived at Harrington Air Base, and there we had these black B-24s, something we hadn't seen, and we didn't quite understand what these black B-24s were for, but we soon found out. It was an OSS base, and it was the beginning of an outfit called the 801st Bombardment Group. At our last reunion, some of the pilots were talking about the fact that the government lost a lot of the records of the 801st, and they seemed to think that they lost them on purpose because of some of the activity that we were involved with. Now, the 8th Air Force in England had 350,000 personnel. They had 112 air bases in England. And on this Harrington Air Base that I was stationed at, there were 3,000 personnel. That's counting everybody from the cooks to pilots to engineers, truck drivers, and what have you. Now, to give you an idea of what a B-24 was that we had, I've brought these pictures. Here we have this black B-24, and it was called a B-24D. It had modifications because there were certain things that they didn't need for the operations that we did. There was no nose turret with 50 caliber machine guns. That's where the navigator and the bombardier looked for signals from the marquee in the underground. And when they had these certain signals, they'd drop their supplies. Now, in the belly of a regular B-24, there's a ball turret. And that ball turret was missing from all of our airplanes. And over that ball turret was a plywood door. And that was called the Joe Hole. And that was where all these OSS agents jumped out of. Now, they jumped out at about 6,000 feet. And another modification of this B-24 was that we didn't have a lot of oxygen systems in it for high altitude bombing like the B-17. And I know you've all read about the B-17 and one of the famous ones, the Memphis Belle. Anybody see that movie?
Yeah.
So, just to give you an idea of how our fellows were involved, we had 26 aircraft missing in action. We had 197 airmen killed in action. We had 11 airmen killed on training missions throughout England. And we flew 3,000 shorties. Those were different missions that we didn't complete the drop or didn't leave supplies to the marquee. We dropped 556 OSS agents. And we didn't lose one agent. in the drop. But if they did get captured, the French Marquis later in the war radioed to us that if any of the French Marquis got caught waiting for some of these drops, the Germans took them down the road and shot them. Towards the end of the war, we made 21 bombing missions, and they were at low altitude because of the oxygen situation. They bombed at 10,000 feet, but after bombing runs, they'd come down to 8,000 feet to come back because of the lack of the oxygen systems in those planes. We dropped 4,511 tons of supplies to the French underground. These planes took off night after night with all these different supplies and agents. Now, an interesting thing is that we've dropped 20,000 Springfield rifles dated 1903 with ammunition to the French Marquis over the 10-month period that I was there. So somewhere in France there's a lot of old Springfield rifles. Now, one of the men that we dropped was Wild Bill Donovan, we call him. He was later head of the OSS, and our pilots tell the story of how we dropped him twice. And the first time we dropped him, he told them when he wanted to jump. He jumped 3 miles this side of a French village that was infested with Nazis, and he finally came back and complaining. The second time that he had to go over and jump, the pilot told him, he says, "I'm running this ship." He says, "I'll tell you when to jump." This OSS was the Office of Strategic Services, and that was started by President Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor happened. Now, you can wonder why or how an airfield with 3,000 men can be secret. Well, it was. And a few years after the war was over, General Eisenhower published a proclamation saying that now we can tell what the 492nd Bomb Group did. And a few years after the war, some of our men went down to Florida to an 8th Air Force reunion. And lo and behold, our outfit wasn't listed as one of the 8th Air Force groups. But we soon straightened that out. And at the Air Force Museum out in Dayton, Ohio, there was a plaque out there to the 8th Air Force, and the 492nd Bomb Group was not listed. Now, how did we get to be recognized? A fellow named Ben Parnell, whom you have a picture of him in your brochure there, wanted to find out how his brother got killed. He was a gunner, and the more he investigated in Washington, the less he found out. So the more he became interested. And by writing to different pilots and ground personnel in the outfit, he compiled this book, Carpetbaggers, and I don't know whether you have read the brochure. Well, okay, if you will. Wonder what carpetbaggers are. That was our code name that was given to us by the Supreme Command. Now, I've been thinking of different things that would interest you, and one of the things that I thought I'd tell you about was the buzz bombs that Hitler had invented. They played havoc with London, and at one point, the French underground notified our Allied forces that the Germans had discovered where these black B-24s were coming from. And from then on, we had to take our guns with us every time we went out on the line to work on the planes and whatever. And there was a flurry of activity with some of these buzz bombs. I call them buzz bombs. It's a nickname for them, but they're really called the V2 bomb. They were launched from Belgium and France by Hitler, and they were pilotless bombs. And they were the cutest things you ever saw going over. It was like the 4th of July. They had these sparks flying out of the back of them, and we didn't pay much attention to them while we could still hear that motor running. But as soon as that motor stopped, we knew that bomb was coming down, and of course it became quite a bit of concern from then on. There wasn't too much activity up where we were with these buzz bombs, but London really caught the brunt of it. Now, when I landed in Harrington, at Harrington Airfield, we were transported from the planes to a tent area. Now, some of these pictures you'll see the tent area that we slept in. There were four bunks to a tent. And the fellow who drove the truck from the airplane to the tent area was Al Savalone, a Concord boy, and I made myself known to him as soon as I saw him, and the first thing he said to me was, "Gee, Horse McCone just landed here this morning," and he was another Concord boy. Here he is here, his real name is Richie McCone. Horse McCone is his nickname, and Richie was a waist gunner, and he had plenty of stories to tell. I want to inject at this point that I don't consider myself any sort of a war hero. I was just over there to do my job for the country and what have you. My job consisted of instruments. There were four instrument specialists on the field, and we did nothing but take care of instruments. And this is our little group right here. And in this group, there's electricians, propeller specialists, the four instrument specialists, and the rest of those fellows are all mechanics or crew chiefs. And then, if you want to see this, these pictures afterwards, you can see the tents that we lived in for the 10 months. In September of 1987, Nancy and I went over to England for a reunion of our group. Actually, we've sort of broken away from the regular 8th Air Force group because you go to an 8th Air Force reunion in Miami, and you know, there'll be over 2,000 fellas there, and you don't know them. Our group was a smaller, close-knit outfit, and I could call every one of those fellas by their first name, and the airbase was a smaller family type affair, and these reunions are great. Well, I was telling you in 87, Nancy and I went over to the reunion in England on the old airfield, and we erected a monument to the 208 guys from our outfit that didn't fly home, and it was quite touching. And the head of the French underground came to our reunion, and his name was Jean Rene, and he presented us with a Croix de Guerre certificate that our outfit had won. The French didn't give many awards to the Americans, so we felt pretty lucky. That is the medal that came with it. But come to find out that only the commanding officer can wear the medal. At this reunion, the head of the Belgian underground was also there at this reunion. And we dropped them both into France and Belgium at various intervals. The head of the French underground, Jean Rene, was captured on one of these drops, and the Germans didn't shoot him. They kept him in jail, and they tortured the heck out of him. And show you what they thought of our outfit. He came to our reunion in Cincinnati a few years ago, and at the 50th anniversary of the World War II, our outfit has been invited to be the guest of the French Marquis in France, and we're going to combine it with a trip to England to the old airfield and a trip to France to visit them. Now, some of our fellows who had to bail out over France stayed with the French underground throughout the war, and they helped blow up bridges and do things of that nature. I always remember one day that a lorry pulled into camp, and a crew that we thought were lost all jumped out, and we were so glad to see them. The French underground got them back to England by way of Spain. They kept passing them along to different farmhouses until they got them into Spain, and then they took a boat from Spain to England. Anybody got any questions that I could answer?
Charlie?
Excuse me, Hank. Don't ask me what some of these agents did, because they never told us.
How long did you spend in that field?
10 months.
10 months?
Yeah.
And where did you go for R&R? Did they let you off the field?
Yes, they did. We had passes to Northampton at various times.
I suppose you
a one-day pass was it, because we worked night and day on these planes to keep them going. But that's a good question, Hank. They used to get us into the headquarters Nissen huts, and before they gave us a day pass, they would instill upon us to keep our mouth shut about the operation at Harrington Airfield. And I always remember one time we were in a pub in Northampton, and two RAF fellows said to us, hey, we know what you're doing over there. And I was, oh, yeah? We wouldn't dare tell them, because naturally it would mean the lives of some of our guys.
You guys did a pretty good job in keeping quiet since nobody knew about the place for so long.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sort of working relationship with the British, or was it an all U.S. operation?
Now, you know, the first, I'm going to come back to your question, but the first Air Force, 8th Air Force missions over Germany were flown with British markings on the airplane, and that was in 1942, and why I really don't know, but that was an interesting point. And the British, the RAF, there was a field near us, an RAF field, and we learned our trade from them. They were doing this before we were. And I think that one of the reasons that the B-24 was selected to do this was that it carried a bigger bomb load than the B-17, which was the Flying Fortress. And it had a longer range than the B-17. And some of those trips to Norway and Sweden to drop agents, they could get back to England. One of our planes went beyond Norway, and they were running low on fuel, so they decided to go to Russia. And the Russians start shooting at them, so they all bailed out. And they didn't have any gas anyway, but they spent the rest of the war in Russia.
I realize
it. Well, thanks for listening.
Well, thank you. Thank you. The names that appear on Concord's World War II memorial have a great deal of meaning to me. Through letters written home by servicemen, including those of Charlie D's cousin, Robert Field, killed in the invasion of Guam, to his mother, Margaret, which numbered over 125, from newspaper accounts of the period and archival materials from the War Records Committee. I have sought to describe the effects of the war on the town and its people. A resulting newspaper series that I wrote for the Concord Journal called They Were Gone When the Morning Came, I was thrilled to learn this past January won a first place award by the New England Press Association. To me, this is a special tribute to the 39 men who fought when the future of the free world hung in the balance and never lived to return to a post-war America. They Were Gone When the Morning Came remembers them. Inscribed on Concord's World War II monument are the words, "The world shall tell how they stood fast and how the fight was won. As long as faith and freedom last and truth goes round the sun." I have a list for you to take afterwards of the names of the servicemen and where they were living in Concord at the time of the war. There are photographs as well that I have reproduced available for you to see on the table here. in memory and tribute to those who served and died in World War II. They were gone when the morning came. There are occurrences so traumatic and all-encompassing that they become a mark of time to which events are placed. Pre- and post-World War II have become such points of reference, watershed passings for this century. Soldier and civilian knew that irrevocable changes were affecting their lives. The impact of a nation mobilizing for war was immediately felt by measures taken locally. In January of 1942, all aliens were ordered to give up cameras and radios to the police department. Air raid black for blackouts in quarts and gallons, read the Concord Journal headlines, while blackout screens were advertised by the Concord Hardware Company on Walden Street. The Committee on Public Safety in Town issued blackout plans and orders, and the local newspaper reported that the first Concord blackout was a huge success. The blackout was observed from the observation tower set up on Neshottoc Hill, considered a good place from which to spot planes, and volunteers signed up for round-the-clock shifts. I remember Helen Shaw telling me how what she almost enjoyed was the social camaraderie, and that it really brought, at a time when this town was not as socially democratic as now, she said people from all walks of life came together and they called each other by the first name. And, you know, Helen was from a time when people had calling cards and so forth, and she said, they called me Helen, they didn't call me Mrs. Shaw. The following month, Inersnack Hill became a lookout to observe the effectiveness of the local blackout. During the course of the war, 80 residents volunteered as airplane spotters. When the Neshottoc Hill observation post closed on May 29, 1944, by order of Secretary of War Stimson, those who had served were commended for keeping the lonely vigil day and night for 2.5 years. The Concord Committee on Public Safety held practice blackout and air raid tests in the little green wooden building next to the Peter Buckley School on Stowe Street. A small group of men and women manned the report center round the clock to answer the telephone and pass on any warning of an air raid which might come from the outside. Since Pearl Harbor, they were ready to, quote, spread the alarm should the call come. They were the night watchmen through the raw cold and hot muggy evenings. An air raid alert signal was 5 short blasts of the town fire whistle repeated once. If a raid was imminent, the signal was 10 blasts repeated once. All clear was 5 short blasts not repeated. If the alarm was at night, a complete blackout was established. Emerson Hospital held blackout drills and urged residents to enroll in blood donor service. A nurses' aid corps was formed in Concord in response to the acute shortage of nurses and offered help for the Red Cross. A Red Cross canteen service was established for servicemen. The Concord Motor Transport was organized, and a servicemen's center opened at 12 Walden Street. The Greater Boston United Fund Campaign and Concord War Bond Committee was extremely well supported in Concord. Women were recruited and responded to the call for civilian defense. The red light of danger has already flashed. The time is right for all women in Concord who have the time to train to do so, said the Concord Journal, following the Pearl Harbor attack. Through the journal, the mobile canteen crew described their work. During the worst period of the Blitz, they provided assistance to a coastal town in England providing meals to civilians whose homes had been destroyed. Within this country, they were helping to feed munition workers during night shifts and agricultural laborers during the harvest season. Editor of the local news, the Concord Journal, Sam Kent wrote editorials to boost morale, and the ads of local businessmen often referred to the war and urged townspeople to buy U.S. war bonds. With the attack on Pearl Harbor still fresh in mind, the Concord National Bank, in its February 5th issue, urged readers to remember the bombing. Concord's Board of Trade, the predecessor to today's Chamber of Commerce, learned about the merits of point rationing, and ration books with coupons for commodities became a dear item. If stocks of canned corn are low, it said, canned corn is given a higher point valuation to shift purchases to the product more plentiful, the newspaper explained to its readers. The local ration board was located in the Veterans Building on Walden Street. The Concord Salvage Committee exhorted the benefits of conservation and recycling through notices and ads such as, save the scrap and win the scrap. Our country needs rubber. Junk makes fighting weapons. Bomb 'em with junk. Junk rally in Concord. This is war, and the more he eats, the harder he hits. Feed him tin cans. McCone's Garage on Lowell Road and the Harness Shop on Main Street in West Concord were salvage depots. Paper was considered vital to victory, and collections were held. The newspaper reported that the Boy Scout paper drive on July 13, 1944, netted 22 tons. And I have pictures of some of that. The scarcity of goods meant illegal profits in the black market by those who found no shortage of buyers. Nylon stockings were a scarcity, since no nylon yarn were allowed for the manufacture of hosiery. Sometimes trucks were hijacked en route to the plant where nylon yarn was to be manufactured into cloth from which parachutes were made, the journal explained, and residents were warned about the nylon hosiery racket, where some people were paying over $5 a pair for black market hosiery that was actually rayon treated with a chemical solution to give it a nylon sheen. It would disintegrate in the first wash. Cigarettes were coveted, and through ads became linked as morale boosters. And some of you remember Dr. Purcell, the first evening, he talked about some of the veterans' medical needs that he is seeing now from the Second World War. Some are quite the result of our culture, which, you know, coveted cigarettes and half a puff soldier, and I have a copy of that, showing the Red Cross girl handing out always welcome cigarettes to a train full of GIs. How very different that would be today. Packages were wrapped for servicemen. Add Victrola records, Tosta iron to bundles for America. The boys are clamoring for them, read a local newspaper notice. Women particularly, those with mechanical ability, were recruited to join the Women's Army Air Corps, the WACs. A WAC is a soldier too, said the ads. Some families had more than one member serving. Five McPhillips brothers, the sons of Jenny McPhillips of Hawthorne Lane, were overseas, while Mr. and Mrs. Nick McCone had six boys in the service. The Concord Journal was sent to all servicemen, and a section was reserved in the newspaper for news about and from servicemen, including their letters.
The local paper was then a link to the whole town. Bob Sheehan expressed his gratitude in a letter to Sam Kent. This is just a line to let you know that although I am on the battlefields of Germany, I am receiving the Concord Journal regularly. Thanks, Sam, for the service. It is quite a thrill to be in a foxhole and have your hometown paper dropped in your lap. Casper Jenny of the Seabees wrote to Kent before that the newspaper had arrived that morning. Before opening it, retired in haste to my foxhole. I read every word, even the want ads. It is a little bit of home, of Concord. How much we miss the everyday life that we are far away from. The last letter received from Naval Officer Lieutenant Whitney Cook, listed as missing after the fall of Bataan, was printed in the local paper, and I will get to that at a later point. Occasional letters of Cook would reach home through the Red Cross during his long imprisonment by the Japanese in the Philippines. So really, the whole town was kind of rooting for him and hoping he would make it back. Sam Kent was a member of the War Records Committee that distributed questionnaires to be answered by the families of servicemen. I found them in the bowels of the library in a carton, and I went through all of them, and it was really a fascinating response where you went through the background of particularly a very important source of information about those killed. It is often the only personal record that remains of these deceased young Concord men and the circumstances relating to their death. According to the committee's records, 14% of Concord's population, 1,032 men and women, were enrolled in the armed services. 591 in the Army, 315 in the Navy, 49 in the Marine Corps, 22 in the Coast Guard, 8 in the Merchant Marine, and 11 women joined the WACS. The first Concord boy killed in action, and I have a photo of him, was George Holliger of the 1st Marine Raider Battalion at Guadalcanal, on October 9, 1942. He died of multiple knife and bayonet wounds. Holliger was posthumously awarded the Presidential Unit Citation and the Navy Cross for heroic action. This citation said, approximately 150 Japanese stealing through the dense jungle growth with cover of smoke fiercely attacked the small group of Marines with automatic weapons, hand grenades, and bayonets. In desperate hand-to-hand combat against overwhelming hostile forces, the men took a tremendous toll of the enemy and died heroically at their post. The name Heiliger was assigned to a destroyer escort vessel in his honor, which was christened in August 1944. 1 month after Heiliger's death, on November 26, Sergeant Kenneth Dunn of Company H also died at Guadalcanal from machine gun fire in the abdomen while waiting for orders at his foxhole. A large crowd paid tribute when Kenneth Dunn Square, at the intersection of Commonwealth Avenue and Lawsbrook Road, was dedicated on May 23, 1943, as a memorial to the first boy to die from West Concord. This reveals the geographic separation that was felt between the two ends of town at that time. A regular contributor to the local newspaper with news of the war was Corporal William Delaney with Company H at Guadalcanal. His letters, said Editor Kent, brought intimate news to the home front. He in turn wrote, that reading is all we have to occupy our spare moments, and the three things of the most interest are Letters from Home, Reader's Digest, and the Concord Journal. I mean, I sound like an ad for the local newspaper. I mean, sometimes you find, as you go through the records, that the deaths occur not in actual combat, but in instances like this. For example, Billy Harlow had sung in nightclubs before enlisting in the Navy. During a leave at home, he was a guest at the Coconut Grove the evening of November 28, 1942, and he lost his life through suffocation with hundreds of others in the disastrous Boston fire. Milton Payne was a principal at Harvey Wheeler School, a very strict principal, his students remember, and he had volunteered in the Naval Air Corps, and he was killed in a training accident in Warrenton, Virginia. Similarly, the news of the death of Lieutenant William Forbes Emerson was from a pilot's accident in California. Explained that a demolition squad was ordered to clear enemy snipers from caves overlooking one of the medical areas. Joe volunteered to lead the demolition group and successfully cleared many caves before he was shot in the chest by a sniper and instantly killed. They breached passages in narrow coral ridges so the tanks could get through, filled gaps in the front yard line, and at night blew caves that the Japanese had hidden in. He made them pay a high price. He was always one of the first to volunteer for a tough job. I've seen his men follow him where no one else wanted to go. Sheehan was described as extremely popular with both officers and men. A good Marine in every sense of the word. It is an honest compliment, and I can't think of any higher one, the man of the 3rd Platoon said in writing to his mother. It is seldom that a man is found who merits both the respect and close friendship of the men he commands and serves with. And I have copies of the letter to his mother. The movies mirrored life locally with films shown at 51 Walden, such as The Purple Heart, starring Dana Andrews and Richard Conte at the Concord Veterans Hall. And on the second floor of that same veterans building, counseling was available for returning servicemen and their families, including job aptitude testing. Some who returned were quite nervous and upset, they wrote, and have not yet gone to work. But they could find jobs that could be filled with, quote, slight nervous disorders. The families of deceased servicemen could also receive help here with insurance and death benefits. Questionnaires were sent by the Concord Veterans Information to servicemen. Their philosophy was to educate the people of Concord to treat returning disabled veterans as human beings, not objects of sympathy or curiosity, nor as wards of the community. I think it's very interesting that that kind of education went on.
Do you have any more blank paper?
No.
Okay. Servicemen often wrote back requesting information on jobs available.
"What have you planned," some said, "for the men that won't be able to work, men who are crippled?" It was an unusual graduation for the class of 1944 at Concord High School. Of 80 members of that class, 17 had already been inducted in the armed services. Of those remaining, all but a baker's dozen are already at work, so that the last days of school saw only 3 or 4 pupils left in each homeroom, reported the newspaper. At the high school graduation the previous year, the mother of William Stewart Gray, Jr., who was inducted in the Army Air Force in March of 1943, proudly received his diploma on his behalf. The following June, she and his father received the War Department telegram notifying them that their son was killed in action off the Dutch New Guiana coast. During one of many night enemy air raids, he was killed instantly, and the enemy airstrip he was bombing was taken the following day. They responded to the War Records Committee questionnaire about the last employment for their son, who had just turned 19, with the answer, "He was just a schoolboy." Less than a week after, Natalie Arena wrote a letter home. He was killed on July 2nd, somewhere in Italy, the soil from which his father had emigrated to Concord. The Arena family farms the acres of the Wilfred Wheeler Homestead on Sudbury Road. In a letter to the journal, Wheeler recalled Arena as so happy in his life on the farm in Concord. "He was never happier than when he was showing me the crops that he helped to grow." Wheeler had received a letter from Arena 1 month before his death. "I am at present somewhere in Italy, where the climate is very suitable for farming, the principal occupation. The soil is very rich and contains plenty of black loam. The land is level and it has no rocks at all. The people here are very friendly and appreciate what our government has done and is doing. This is your friend Arena saying so long and best of luck to you all." Wheeler said, "I wrote to him at once and hoped that he got it before he was killed." The same day that Arena died, Second Lieutenant Caleb Wheeler was reported missing in action over Budapest, Hungary. Wheeler was flying his 10th mission as a navigator. The bombs had been dropped on the oil refineries when Nazi fighters shot down all the B-24s in the rear group, and Wheeler's plane fell in flames. He was unable to get out through the escape hatch in time. The air raid was considered one of the massive and daring strikes to overcome Germany. Wheeler himself is described as a quiet, gentle, almost shy farm boy growing up along Virginia Road in the farmhouse where Henry David Thoreau was born. He was enrolled at the Harvard Graduate School in the fall of 1943. He had married that January, and the next month he had entered the service as an aviation cadet. Local residents began to see German prisoners brought down from Fort Devens, and I have a picture of the German prisoners of war working on the Wheeler farm. They worked on a variety of farms here. 10 were working for Tom McGrath on Barrett's Mill Road. 19 for the, is it Gia Arrigo Brothers? Is that how you pronounce it? At 9 Acre Corner, where the Neshata Country Club is now. And 11 for the Wheeler Farm on 9 Acre Corner. August ended with, August 1944 ended with the announcement of the death of Robert Field, a Marine corporal who was killed on the first day of the invasion of Guam. Robert Field was Charlie D's cousin. There's a picture of him and his mother, Margaret Bent. There are uniforms of his. His mother, of course, was Charlie's aunt, and today Charlie and Nancy live in their home on 9 Acre Corner, where the memory of his cousin is very much alive. He had, the year the war began was the year he graduated as senior, as president of his senior class at Concord High School. He wrote many letters to his mother, and they numbered each of their letters. And I was able to read, I guess, over 125 of these letters that Charlie and Nancy loaned to me. The last six of these letters were returned unopened, undeliverable, which presaged the official notice of his death. So it is an unusual opportunity for somebody later on like myself to see what his mother was writing to him. And actually, these letters were just recently, you know, when around the time of this project, opened by Nancy. And it's really hard to, keep a dry eye when you read through this. Even someone like myself who didn't know him, you feel like you do know him. You don't know how happy letters make me. I sure would like to see all the folks, friends, and Concord again. In fact, I'd like to be home for a while, he wrote in February of 1943, after spending his first Christmas away from home. We've been out here quite a while now, and I've had enough of it. Of course, I shouldn't complain, because a lot of the boys are really having it tough. Jane, who was his fiancée, told me that so much of her salary is being put away for our future days. What I wouldn't give to wake up and find myself in my own bed some morning, then go downstairs to a nice breakfast. I miss all these things, but I guess the things I miss most are people. I love you, Ma. Someday I'll be home to show you what I think of you. It certainly has been a lonely 2 years for us all, he wrote in November of 1943. But I guess there are a lot more people in the world who are suffering much more than we are. When looking around, you sure find a strange and different world today. I certainly hope that the year ahead of us will find us back to a normal civilization again. Unfortunately, Christmas this year will be spent with that bit of loneliness that we both know by now, Mom. But that is something that we have both learned to take. Next Christmas, we should all be back where we belong, he wrote optimistically. So just keep thinking of this and help speed the months along. At this time, I'm not able to tell you where you are, but I can assure you, Mom, that you can relax a bit, for I will be safely out of danger for quite a while. Who knows? Someday soon, I might make a landing on a California beach. On July 21st, 1944, Corporal Robert Edward Field was killed by a Japanese sniper on the first day of the invasion of Guam. He had served in the Asiatic Pacific area from July 19, 1942 to July 21, 1944. He is interred not in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, where the D's have buried so many of Concord residents, but in the National Memorial Cemetery, Punchbowl Crater, Honolulu, Hawaii. The letters written by his mother to him and returned add another perspective of the correspondence. The intent, optimistically, was to move time one step further to Bobby's homecoming, but ended with a fatal finality. "Please God, send you home to us soon," she wrote in a July 1944 letter, 4 days before his death. "Don't you really think that you'll come home this fall?" "Jane is coming out on Thursday to spend the night with us, and Papa, the grandfather, will come for supper. We'll try to make her birthday happy, just a wee bit happy, for I know she's pretty lonesome. She's just like you in so many ways, sort of deep, and though she doesn't say much, she's very serious." "Is there any end to this thing, Bobby?" she implored. And in her final attempt at contact with him on August 26, 1944, she wrote, "Are you all right, Bobby? I won't be normal until I do hear from you. I hope and pray I hear from you soon, and then I'll know whether I'm coming or going. I love you, Bobby dear, more than anything in this world." Bill Taller delivered the official word of death, the dreaded Western Union telegram, and I have a copy of that particular telegram here. Along with condolences came the reminder of the need for security, and included the request to prevent possible aid to our enemies, do not divulge the name of his ship or station. When prisoners of war were freed in the Philippines, people hoped to hear about Lieutenant Whitney Cook, a prisoner of war for so long. And finally, on June 18th, his father, Harry, received word of his final fate. On December 13th, he received it on June of 1945. On December 13th, 1944, Cook was among the prisoners of war placed on an unmarked transport at Manila to Japan. 2 days later, the ship was sunk by U.S. bombs and torpedoes off Subic Bay, the Philippine Islands, killing 350 captured Americans. Survivors reported that the Japanese guards on the ship machine gunned those who tried to swim to shore. On the day he left Bilibid Prison, Manila, for the Japanese transport, he wrote a letter to his father that was brought home. Despite his imprisonment for 2 years and 4 months, it reveals an incredible optimism that he would make it through. It seems rather funny leaving with the Yanks so close by. "We have had our share of tough luck here in PI, but it has never gotten us down. Old Wit has kept smiling, and today's departure is just another disappointment that we have to face with our chins up. Starvation is an everyday experience with us, and we only get 2 meals of rice a day. We spend hours on end discussing cooking and food of all descriptions, and the kitchen will be a stomping ground for me when I get out. I feel that sometime next year I shall be home for our reunion, and if we move out today, it will merely postpone my homecoming for several months. I am always thinking of you and hoping and praying that this war will be over soon. Your loving son, Whitney. The war had ended, but Lieutenant Richard Mara's long-awaited trip home never came. On October 13, 1945, the glider pilot was killed in an accident over Ashburton, England. He had been given, quote, an erroneous heading, leaving the field in Exeter, England, and crashed into a mountain. During the war, he had supplied General George Patton's army with food and ammunition. His thoughts remain through letters written to his brother, the late Charles Mara, and sister-in-law Mary. I'm hoping I don't see two Christmases over here, but only God knows about that. If Mary can do anything to make the time pass more pleasantly for Allison, who was his wife, it will be greatly appreciated. If you can get cigarettes, Chuck, get them and send them. They're rather scarce. I wish you would thank the KFC for me as I received their Christmas package. I also received a Christmas card from the Concord Library. I will write them a thank you when I get the time. It's not exactly like the States over here, Chuck. You don't know when you're going to be, quote, busy. I can say that I've seen most of England, part of Scotland, and some of France. You can believe the stories of the amount of bombers hitting Germany, as I counted them a number of times, and I only see part. I've seen some of the ruins that the bombs do. What a feeling it is to receive mail. I can't describe it to you, except if you feel rather gloomy, and mail comes in and you get some, it seems to pick you up and put you on your feet again. I'm supposed to get 1,000 hours and 2 years in over here before seeing home again. That is the present setup, but I hope to hell they change it. That is a long time. The war news is damn good at the present, Chuck. I guess you read it in the papers, and Allison's last letter said that the Germans were being attacked 75 miles from Berlin. The Russians are a hell of a lot closer to Berlin than that. We're moving too. Just keep little Charlie remembering his uncle. He'll be able to go hunting with us when I get home. Chuck, I hear you're trying to still get in the CBs. Please take my advice and stay the hell out of it. If you're going to get in the Navy. Don't get in anything that you will have to fight on land. It's no fun. I don't want anyone at home to be worrying now. It's great getting mail from home. Now I'm going to give you a little hell. You signed your letter with 4F. Someone should give you a boot in the ass for trying to get in. The ground fighting is no good. I've seen it, and it's not very pleasant to dream it. God has been very good to me, and sis, and I mean that. I've had a few doubts about seeing home again. I'm thankful I'm in one place. I don't know whether I'm yellow or not, but here's one little boy that has been thoroughly frightened for once in his life. Anyone that went in on the job that says he was not afraid is lying like hell. The war news for this theater is very good, and if things continue as they have been, we all might see home sooner than we expected. All the armies are moving and on their way right through Germany. I've seen some of Germany, and it's really lowered. The boys and the bombers did a good job. One large city, bigger than Boston, is now just a mass of rubbish. Germany is taking the beating she deserves, and unconditional surrender is the only way to end it all. It will be a good many years before Germany is ever rebuilt. We are still in tents, but it is not too bad. Living is quite primitive, but hell, we're not complaining. The guys up there fighting sleep in the foxholes are plenty cold. They also fill up with water, and you lay in it, and thank the good Lord that you have a hole to be in. Not complaining, Chuck, just stating facts. I've got no kicks. Lots of love to all the family, and tell Charlie Jr. that if he's not a good boy, I'll not take him hunting when I get home. In December, townspeople learned of the tragic death of 19-year-old Dominic Rizzitano, stationed in the Philippines. Information from the Naval Department related that he was on his way to his radio post for the midnight watch when he was ambushed and killed by four black sailors. One of the sailors had been released from the prison stockade where he said he was beaten by a white guard. Rizzitano had appeared at the wrong place at the wrong time. He was an innocent victim of racial hate. Ironically, they had chosen a gentle young man who at age 15 had saved a child from drowning in the Concord River. Before volunteering for the Navy, at age 17, Rizzitano had given many hours as an observer at the aircraft warning tower on the Shattuck Hill where he lived. The 1946 town report listed 39 deaths in the Second World War, and when they read the names out on Memorial Day, they all have great meaning to me now. It said Concord is justly proud of the service of its sons and daughters, and the story of the service should be suitably preserved. Well, it never was, and maybe I could make some contribution here. The data cards of the War Records Committee were to be the basis of a valuable record for the future. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we shall remember them. Thank you.